Chapter 66. Few men were ever interviewed oftener than Mark Twain, yet he never welcomed interviewers, and was seldom satisfied with them. Had I say in an interview loses its character in print, he often remarked, LL its life and personality. The reporter realizes this himself, and tries to improve upon me, but he doesn't help matters any. Edward W. Bach, before he became editor of the Ladies' Home Journal, was conducting a weekly syndicate column under the title of OK's Literary Leaves. It usually consisted of news and gossip of writers, comment, etc., literary odds and ends, and occasional interviews with distinguished authors. He went up to Hartford one day to interview Mark Twain. The result seemed satisfactory to Bach, but wishing to be certain that it would be satisfactory to Clemens, he sent him a copy for approval. The interview was not returned. In the place of it came a letter not altogether disappointing, as the reader may believe. To Edward W. Bach, in New York. My dear Mr. Bach, no. It is like most interviews, pure twaddle and valueless. For several quite plain and simple reasons, an interview must, as a rule, be an absurdity, and chiefly for this reason it is an attempt to use a boat on land or a wagon on water, to speak figuratively. Spoken speech is one thing, written speech is quite another. Print is the proper vehicle for the latter, but it isn't for the former. The moment talk is put into print you recognize that it is not what it was when you heard it. You perceive that an immense something has disappeared from it. That is its soul. You have nothing but a dead carcass left on your hands. Color, play of feature, the varying modulations of the voice, the laugh, the smile, the unforming inflections, everything that gave that body warmth, grace, friendliness and charm, and commended it to your affections or, at least, to your tolerance is gone and nothing is left but a pallid, stiff and repulsive cadaver. Such is almost invariably, as you see it lying in state in an interview. The interviewer seldom tries to tell one how a thing was said. He merely puts in the naked remark and stops there. When one writes for print his methods are very different. He follows forms which have but little resemblance to conversation, but they make the reader understand what the writer is trying to convey. And when the writer is making a story, and finds it necessary to report some of the talk of his characters, observe how cautiously and anxiously he goes at that risky and difficult thing. If he had dared to say that thing in my presence, said Alfred, taking a mock heroic attitude, and casting an arch glance upon the company, blood would have flowed. If he had dared to say that thing in my presence, said Hawkwood, with that in his eye which caused more than one heart in that guilty assemblage to quake, blood would have flowed. If he had dared to say that thing in my presence, said the paltry blusterer, with valor on his tongue and pallor on his lips, blood would have flowed. So painfully aware is the novelist that naked talk in print conveys no meaning that he loads, and often overloads, almost every utterance of his characters with explanations and interpretations. It is a loud confession that print is a poor vehicle for awk. It is a recognition that uninterpreted talk in print would result in confusion to the reader, not instruction. Now, in your interview, you have certainly been most accurate. You have set down the sentences I uttered as I said them. But you have not a word of explanation. What my manner was at several points is not indicated. Therefore, no reader can possibly know where I was in earnest, and where I was joking, or whether I was joking altogether or in earnest altogether. Such a report of a conversation has no value. It can convey many meanings to the reader, but never the right one. To add interpretations which would convey the right meaning is a something which would require what? An art so high, and fine and difficult, that no possessor of it would ever be allowed to waste it on interviews. No, spare the reader, and spare me, leave the whole interview out, it is rubbish. I wouldn't talk in my sleep, if I couldn't talk better than that. If you wish to print anything, print this letter. It may have some value, for it may explain to a reader here and there why it is that in interviews, as a rule, men seem to talk like anybody but themselves. Very sincerely yours, Mark Twain. XXIX, Letters, 1889. The Machine. Death of Mr. Crane. Conclusion of the Yankee in January, 1889. Clemens believed, after his long 7 years of waiting, fruition had come in the matter of the type machine. Page, the inventor, seemed at last to have given it its finishing touches. The mechanical marvel that had cost so much time, mental stress, and a fortune in money, stood complete, responsive to the human will, and touched the latest, and one of the greatest, wonders of the world. To George Standring, a London printer and publisher, Clemens wrote, "The machine is finished," and added, "This is by far the most marvelous invention ever contrived by man. And it is not a thing of rags and patches, it is made of massive steel, and will last a century." In his fever of enthusiasm on that day, when he had actually seen it in operation, he wrote a number of exuberant letters. They were more or less duplicates, but as the one to his brother is of fuller detail and more intimate than the others, it has been selected for preservation here. To Orion Clemens, in Keokuk, Hartford. January 5, 89. Dear Orion, at 12:20 this afternoon a line of movable types was spaced and justified by machinery for the first time in the history of the world, and I was there to see. It was done automatically, instantly, perfectly. This is indeed the first line of movable types that ever was perfectly spaced and perfectly justified on this earth. This was the last function that remained to be tested, and so by long odds the most amazing and extraordinary invention ever born of the brain of man stands completed and perfect. Livy is downstairs celebrating. But it's a cunning devil, is that machine, and knows more than any man that ever lived. You shall see. We made the test in this way. We set up a lot of random letters in a stick 3/4 of a line. Then filled out the line with quads representing 14 spaces, each space to be 35/1000 of an inch thick. Then we threw aside the quads, and put the letters into the machine, and formed them into 15 two-letter words, leaving the words separated by 2-inch vacancies. Then we started up the machine slowly, by hand, and fastened our eyes on the space selecting pins. The first pin block projected its third pin as the first word came traveling along the raceway. Second block did the same, but the third block projected its second pin. Oh, hell! Stop the machine, something wrong, it's going to set a 31,000 space. General consternation. Foreign substance has got into the spacing plates. This from the head mathematician. Yes, that is the trouble, assented the foreman. Page examined. Oh, look in, and you can see that there's nothing of the kind. Further examination. Oh, I know what it is, what it must be. One of those plates projects and binds. It's too bad, the first test is a failure. A pause. L, boys, no use to cry. Get to work, take the machine down. No, hold on. Don't touch a thing. Go right ahead. We are fools, the machine isn't. The machine knows what it's about. There is a speck of dirt on one of those types, and the machine is putting in a thinner space to allow for it. That was just it. The machine went right ahead, spaced the line, justified it to a hair, and shoved it into the galley complete and perfect. We took it out, and examined it with a glass. You could not tell by your eye that the third space was thinner than the others, but the glass and the calipers showed the difference. Page had always said that the machine would measure invisible particles of dirt and allow for them, but even he had forgotten that vast fact for the moment. All the witnesses made written record of the immense historical birth, the first justification of a line of movable type by machinery, and also set down the hour and the minute. Nobody had drank anything, and yet everybody seemed drunk. Well, dizzy, stupefied, stunned. All the other wonderful inventions of the human brain sink pretty nearly into commonplace contrasted with this awful mechanical miracle. Telephones, telegraphs, locomotives, cotton gins, sewing machines, Babbage calculators, Jacquard looms, perfecting presses, Arkwright frames, all mere toys, simplicities. The page compositor marches alone and far in the lead of human inventions. In 2 or 3 weeks we shall work the stiffness out of her joints, and have her performing as smoothly and softly as human muscles, and then we shall speak out the big secret, and let the world come and gaze. Return me this letter, when you have read it. Sam. Judge of the elation which such a letter would produce in Keokuk. Yet it was no greater than that which existed in Hartford for a time. Then further delays. Before the machine got the stiffness out of her joints, that unnamed devil manifested a tendency to break the types, and Page, who was never happier than when he was pulling things to pieces and making improvements, had the typesetter apart again, and the day of complete triumph was postponed. There was sadness at the Elmira farm that spring. Theodore Crane, who had long been in poor health, seemed to grow daily worse. In February he had paid a visit to Hartford, and saw the machine in operation, but by the end of May his condition was very serious. Remembering his keen sense of humor, Clemens reported to him cheering and amusing incidents. To Mrs. Theodore Crane. In Elmira, N. Y. : Hartford, May 28, 89. Susie dear, I want you to tell this to Theodore. You know how absent, dash-minded Twitchell is, and how desolate his face is when he is in that frame. At such times, he passes the word with a friend on the street, and is not aware of the meeting at all. Twice in a week, our Clara had this latter experience with him within the past month. But the second instance was too much for her, and she woke him up, in his tracks, with a reproach. She said, Uncle Joe, why do you always look as if you were just going down into the grave, when you meet a person on the street? And then went on to reveal to him the funereal spectacle which he presented on such occasions. Well, as he has met Twitchell 3 times since then, and would swim the Connecticut, to avoid meeting him the fourth. As soon as he sights her, no matter how public the place nor how far off she is, he makes a bound into the air, heaves arms and legs into all sorts of frantic gestures of delight, and so comes prancing, skipping, and pirouetting for her like a drunken Indian entering heaven. With a full invoice of love from us all to you and Theodore. S50. See, the reference in the next to the losing sentence in a letter written by Howells to Clemens about this time, refers to a heartbroken utterance of the former concerning his daughter Winnie, who had died some time before. As he had been a gentle talented girl, but never of robust health. Her death had followed a long period of gradual decline. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford, Judy 13, 89. Dear Howells, I came on from Elmira a day or two ago, where I left a house of mourning. Mr. Crane died, after 10 months of pain and 2 whole days of dying, at the farm on the hill, the third inst. A man who had always hoped for a swift death. Mrs. Crane and Mrs. Clemens and the children were in a gloom which brought back to me the days of 19 years ago, when Mr. Langdon died. It is heartbreaking to see Mrs. Crane. Many a time, in the past 10 days, the sight of her has reminded me, with a pang, of the desolation which uttered itself in the closing sentence of your last letter to me. I do see that there is an argument against suicide. The grief of the worshippers left behind, the awful famine in their hearts, these are too costly terms for the release. I shall be here 10 days yet, and all alone. Nobody in the house but the servants. Can Mrs. Howells spare you to me? Can you come and stay with me? The house is cool and pleasant. Your work will not be interrupted. We will keep to ourselves, and let the rest of the world do the same. You can have your choice of 3 bedrooms, and you will find the children's schoolroom which was built for my study. The perfection of a retired and silent den for work. There isn't a fly or a mosquito on the estate. Come, say you will. With kindest regards to Mrs. Howells, and Pilla and John, yours ever, Mark. Howells was more hopeful. He wrote, I read something in a strange book, The Physical Theory of Another Life, that consoles a little. Namely, we see and feel the power of deity in such fullness, that we ought to infer the infinite justice and goodness which we do not see or feel. And a few days later, he wrote, I would rather see, and talk with you than any other man in the world outside my own blood. A Connecticut Yankee at King Arthur's court was brought to an end, that year and given to the artist and printer. Dan Beard was selected for the drawings, and was given a free hand, as the next letter shows. To Fred J. Hall, Manager Charles 50, Webster & Company, Charles 50. Webster, owing to poor health, had by this time retired from the firm. Elmira, July 20, 89. Dear Mr. Hall, upon reflection thus, tell Beard to obey his own inspiration, and when he sees a picture in his mind, put that picture on paper, be it humorous, or be it serious. I want his genius to be wholly unhampered. I shan't have fears as to the result. They will be better pictures than if I mixed in and tried to give him points on his own trade. Send this note and he'll understand. Here's 50. See, Clemens had made a good choice in selecting Beard for the illustrations. He was well qualified for the work, and being of a socialistic turn of mind put his whole soul into it. When the drawings were completed, Clemens wrote, hold me under permanent obligations. What luck it was to find you. There are hundreds of artists that could illustrate any other book of mine, but there was only one who could illustrate this one. Yes, it was a fortunate hour that I went netting for lightning bugs and caught a meteor. Live forever. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.